For the week of February 27th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 94, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at a candlelight vigil outside the home of Charlie Sheen, I'm Michael Giltz.
I don't know if he needs a candlelight vigil yet.
He needs something.
Well, you're going to have to excuse me, Michael, if I'm a little tired and sleepy on today's episode. I just, for some reason, I'm just so exhausted.
Were you at the Oscars Sunday night or the parties?
No. I wasn't at the Oscars. In fact, I think the reason I'm so tired is because I think I slept through the Oscars. And you know how when you get too much sleep sometimes, your body just stays asleep?
I get you.
But yes, on today's show, we will be talking all about the Oscars and all the big winners and losers. And when we're not talking about the Oscars, we'll be talking about the Oscars. In fact, Ann Thompson of IndieWire will be joining us a little later on to give us all her thoughts on the awards weekend. And actually, as Michael mentioned, we do have some other news to talk about, like Charlie Sheen's attempt to upstage the Oscars by behaving like... Actually, I'm not quite sure there are words to describe how Charlie Sheen has been behaving lately. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one film at the box office this weekend was Romeo and Juliet, the animated film with songs by Elton John. Its third weekend release, it is now the number one film in the country for the first time. That's a rare feat. And a good one for it. It grossed $14.2 million. It's at $75 million total on a reported budget of around $45 to $50 million. So this is turning into a very serious win for Disney. At number two is Hall Pass, the Judd Apatow film, which grossed $13.4 million, well down from what they were hoping for. And number three is the Liam Neeson thriller Unknown, which grossed another $12.4 million. That's at $42 million total, not bad for a film that cost only $30 million to make. And number four is the Adam Sandler comedy Just Go With It, which grossed another $11 million and is now at $80 million total. And number five is the Pettifer film, I Am Number Four, which grossed $11 million and is now at $37 million total. Number six is Justin Bieber, Never Say Never, which was re-released into theaters with a director's cut. It grossed another $9 million, quite a good hold. It only dropped 30%. It's at $62 million total. And number seven is The King's Speech, the big winner at the Oscars. It grossed $7.6 million, which is effing great. It's $114 million total in the U.S. and another $134 million overseas. So you're now looking at a $250 million gross on a very modestly budgeted film.
You know, for a second there, I thought you were going to go all Melissa Leo on us.
At number eight is Big Mamas Like Father Like Son, the Martin Lawrence comedy, which is at $28 million total. At number nine, the not really a surprise, but the real bomb of the week is the Nicolas Cage film Drive Angry, which opened, or really didn't open, at $5.1 million, which is just a shocking rejection of a film. And number 10 is The Roommate, the silly little thriller, which grossed $35 million so far.
But, you know, it was made for $16 million, so.
That's right. It's a financial hit. And Black Swan, which also won the Oscar for Natalie Portman, that's grossed about $100 million in the U.S. and another $100 million overseas, which is a very big win for an art film like this. And Tangled, which lost out on the Oscar for Best Original Song and wasn't even nominated for Best Animated Film, that grossed $525 million worldwide and counting. So it's over half a billion dollars now for the Disney animated film, and it's still going very strong in Europe.
So you're saying ultimately, though, it's a disappointment because it didn't reach $1 billion.
Yeah, that's right. It's not one of the five highest grossing movies of all time.
Right, exactly. Well, and you know, you said that, you know, the results for Drive Angry are a shocking rejection of a film. I wonder if it's not a shocking rejection of one of my former bosses, Nicolas Cage.
I don't think so. I mean, like a lot of actors who've had long careers, he's made movies that made tons of money, movies that made very little. This one is doing very poorly, as well as his last two or three movies like The Sorcerer's Apprentice and some other flicks, but I don't think there's any reason why he couldn't be in a big hit again. It's just a very, very bad anonymous movie dumped in the end of February. You know, that's where bad movies go to die.
Yeah, I mean, my advice to him would be go away for a while and let people forget about all of these movies that you've done that really aren't that great, frankly, and then come back with kind of an art film.
Well, it's never a good idea to make a bunch of bad movies. So certainly taking a smaller role in a high-quality film rather than trying to get another paycheck is always a good idea to revive interest in your career.
I think he might have to continue starring in these movies where he receives big paychecks, because I think he owes a little bit of money to the U.S. government. And if he doesn't pay them back, he will soon become Wesley Snipes' cellmate.
Roommate, yeah. Oh, well.
Well, did you see any movies over the weekend?
No, I was just preparing, of course, for the Oscars, the holiest day of the year in Hollywood.
The holiest. It's the high holy days. Yeah, I saw Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, how was it?
It was, you know, cute. It was a cute little film. The story felt somewhat familiar.
Was it? Yeah. Was it? what was the animation like?
The animation was kind of like this claymation animation. You couldn't really put your finger on it. It wasn't exactly claymation, but it wasn't exactly animation. So it was this hybrid of the two. But, you know, it worked. I think that for children, it went way over their heads.
Mm-hmm. So is it sort of like Flushed Away, that Aardvark film, which was there? They specialized in stop motion sort of claymation stuff, but then they made a film that looked like claymation but was in fact 2D animation.
By aardvark you mean Aardman?
I mean Aardman.
Yeah, I mean it was
the people behind Wallace and Gromit.
Yeah, it was somewhat like that, although less so. It wasn't as claymation like.
Would you recommend it?
I would recommend it. Yeah, I mean I certainly on video. It's certainly worth a watch on video.
All right.
What I loved was hearing one of the younger patrons sitting there watching the movie saying, "Wow, the music was really good. Who did the music?" I'm like, "You're just a little guy named Elton John, my friend."
Hey, they know who he is. He did The Lion King and Billy Elliot. They know who Elton John is.
They were born well after The Lion King.
But they've watched it a billion times.
I bet you're right.
Well, we should probably move on to the Oscar winners before we forget exactly which ones they are.
Yes, exactly. And to do that, we are being joined by Ann Thompson, who, of course, is with IndieWire. And you can read her work on the Thompson on Hollywood blog. Also, she is on Twitter at AK Stanwyck. And we will, of course, place all of those links in the show notes. And thank you for joining us. You had a busy weekend.
It was fun. It's really fun. No, I mean, it all comes to an end and you know, I'm glad it's over. But, you know, the Oscar season, you know, was interesting this year. Nothing was for sure.
Well, in what way was nothing for sure? Because it seemed to me watching the Oscars that everybody who was expected to win won, except for maybe, and I know that Michael and I disagree on this, I thought David Fincher would win for The Social Network, and it was Tom Hooper for Best Director for The King's Speech.
The reason that was under so much debate was because ordinarily, if you really do have a Guild winner like The King's Speech expected to win Best Picture, most of the time the DGA winner does go to the Best Picture winner as well. And so it was expected in a way that it would be Tom Hooper, but a lot of people, meeting included, figured that they would give it to the more respected Hollywood insider David Fincher for The Social Network, and that there was a real battle between those two films.
How did you do in your Oscar ballot? I think we tied.
The worst I've done in years.
You got 17 out of 24?
No, it don't even go. I basically knew exactly what I was risking. And if you read my final sort of accounting of what to vote for, I sort of said, go with the front runner in most of these categories while I go out on a limb and pick Annette Bening and, Helena Bonham Carter. I was just being sort of daring and stupid in a couple of categories. But, you know, it's hard to call some of those. I knew that the technical categories were going to split and that it was going to be Inception versus Alice in Wonderland, and it was. But it wasn't. I mean, I didn't expect King's Speech to win more than 4 or 5, and they won 4, and Inception won 4. So it sort of went the way I thought it would. You just had to pick the right ones, you know.
Well, the show dropped about 10% in the ratings from last year, despite having James Franco and Anne Hathaway as the hosts and a lot of quite popular films up for the Best Picture nomination. It ranked 8th, rather, out of the last 11 Oscar telecasts, so it's in the bottom half. What was your verdict on the show creatively, Anne, and the hosts in particular?
Well, I thought Anne Hathaway did a lot better than James Franco, who just seemed exhausted, you know? I mean, he just seemed to be phoning it in and not having found whatever the persona was that he should be playing. And I'm not sure I understand. I think he's the kind of guy who sort of goes, hey, I'll do anything. I'll just try anything, you know? And he's got some video footage that he shot behind. He's tweeting. He's putting up, you know, his terrible version of Cher's burlesque song on, you know, his... his Twitter account and everything. So he gained an enormous amount of fame from the whole process. I mean, his, you know, TVQ must have gone up, but I don't think he made a very effective host. And I think that it does suggest that when Billy Crystal came on, there was a sense of relief.
Yes. I couldn't believe I was like, oh, wow, they're bringing him out. And I think everybody was like, please stay, please stay.
But I did like the opening film. I thought Franco was great in the opening film that Troy Miller did. It was really witty and fun, the Inception dream levels with Alec Baldwin and Morgan Freeman, you know. But as far as being a host, I didn't think it worked at all. But it was one of the shorter shows. What is the real explanation for why it didn't do better in the ratings? Because I understand that there were never more tweets of the show than there were this year. So there was this sort of collective experience going on.
My philosophy on that is last year you had Avatar, which was the biggest film of all time, the highest grossing film of all time. So, of course, the ratings were going to be up last year, and they would probably take a small dip this year because you didn't have an Avatar. Instead, you had some, you know, Toy Story 3 and Inception, some big movies, but then you had some highbrow films like Black Swan, True Grit, and of course, The King's Speech. So, you know, it really does skew a little bit older this year.
I agree with you. I think that's probably the case. But, here's my issue. I just think the Academy, first of all, I object to the 10 films. I still think there should be 5. I want to know what those 5 films were. The fact that I don't know what the 5 films were makes me crazy, you know? And I want to know that they're taking this seriously as an Oscar cast that has to do with rewarding the best every year and make it for adults. Forget about trying to make it appeal to kids. I think that's a doomed enterprise.
I think this year certainly proved that. And if you really look at this whole idea of having 10 films, specifically having Toy Story 3 nominated, which was a great film and it won the Best Animated Feature category. But when you really look at it and you look at the way they cut those montages together, Toy Story 3 was hardly ever shown. They only ever like put a few clips within any montage of the Best Picture nominees.
Yeah, no, I agree that I like the 10 best films of the year. I think it makes sense, but I do think they should celebrate movies. It drives me nuts every year that you can watch the Oscars and have absolutely no idea what even the basic plot of almost any film is that they're awarding. If they'd have longer, more substantial clips for all the acting categories and all the Best Picture nominees, they'd actually celebrate film and let people know what the movies are that they're supposedly praising.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I did like the fact that they brought this, given especially this year that they had such big names involved in the best songs, that they had Randy Newman and A.R. Rahman and Gwyneth up there singing their song. So that was great.
I was a little surprised that we didn't see more of people like Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, those side shots when they cut to the audience. And likewise, I don't think they cut to Natalie Portman once.
Hmm. Well, the show was very desperately produced. They suddenly threw in some video of people on the street talking about their favorite movie song. Then they threw in the idea that had happened under the recent Oscar cast where the presenters praise all 5 nominees. It was sort of a desperate melange of everything that they'd done in the last decade.
I thought Sandra Bullock was really great, though.
Oh, she was fantastic.
I want her to be the new host. This is my – of course, she's an Oscar-winning actress who has better things to do, and it would probably be her idea of torture, but she'd be great.
When she turned to Colin Firth and said, you do want to go home again sometime, right? The queen did like the film. I thought, you know, it was so well-timed. And
she's got great timing. That's the thing. She's as good a comedian as any of the comic hosts could be.
What about the much vaunted virtual sets that kept telling us how they were going to immerse us in the environment of a film? It would look like they were on an animated film for Toy Story, or it would look like you were there at Gone with the Wind, and it was like a backdrop behind the people. It was so banal, I couldn't believe it.
I agree with you. I agree with you. But, it's. I think that they will hopefully learn from their mistakes as they do every year. But there's something about it that stays the same, you know, and that's what's going to continue. I mean, I wouldn't want them to change. My attitude has always been don't change it up too much because it is what it is for a reason, you know.
Right. But I have to say that, you know, you mentioned that they were aiming for a younger demographic. They mentioned that they were aiming for a younger demographic. Anne Hathaway comes out and, you know, I guess James Franco said, oh, Anne, you look very lovely. She turns to James Franco and says, oh, well, you look very appealing to a younger demographic as well. So they have that going on. And then they have this tribute to Bob Hope. And I thought,
I didn't get that at all.
Where are you? I mean, you're either appealing to an older demographic or you're trying to appeal to a younger demographic, but you're trying to split hairs here is not working at all. And all I could think during that opening monologue there was, at what point do the producers and directors of the Oscar telecast pick up the phone and speed dial Ricky Gervais?
No, you don't want that. You really don't. Because I guess what I'm trying to say is that I do want the Oscars to stay classy. And they still matter and they're still important. And just looking at all the media that cover it and all the noise in the blogosphere that I participate in and all the people who care about it, it's still important. And it's important because it's about quality. And it's about rewarding quality. And the fact that people believe that the Oscars voters are actually worth paying attention to, that they care about what good films are. And as long as that's true, the Oscars will matter.
I like that they announced in the middle of the show about the renewal with ABC as if anybody cared that the Oscar contract had been renewed for another X number of years. It was such a dorky thing to do on air.
Yeah, I actually agree with that too.
I was a little worried that they wouldn't get their contract picked up after this last year.
It wasn't that bad.
It's always a bad show, to be fair. It's always a dull, ungainly show, and they have to show all these tech categories that most people don't really care about. So it's always got that trouble, you know, in it. But I don't think they needed to end with a bunch of kids from New York City public schools lip-syncing to Over the Rainbow. That was bizarre. Were you seeing it on TV or were you backstage?
I was backstage, but it was on TV. But I wasn't looking at it that closely, obviously.
So now you were backstage, Anne. So let me ask you this. And this kind of relates to the PS22 or 122 or whatever their PS happens to be. And that is, you had to wear an evening gown and the men had to wear tuxedos. And you are kind of you're not even backstage. You're all the way in the Renaissance Hotel, which is kind of a bit of a walk from the Kodak Theater. And yet you all have to dress up. Then at the very end of the show, they bring these kids on with these t-shirts. I thought, you know, this is supposed to be a classy event, and they even make journalists who will never be seen on television dress up, and yet they bring these kids out in t-shirts.
I did get to go to the governor's ball afterwards, so my oh. outfit was not wasted.
Was that your first time?
No. No, I've been to the show. I've actually gone to the show. I was on the red carpet and in the bleachers, you know, where they have a little place for all the press to reach over and interview people who go by. And I was backstage. I've been, they give you a walk around to the governor's ball sometimes, you know, where you get to go. You don't sit down and eat dinner, but you get to sort of wander around and accost people.
Hopefully Oscar winners
and Oscar losers.
That's true.
Or Melissa Leo, who was both an Oscar winner and an Oscar loser.
Well, I think it's embarrassing that she's going to be remembered forever for the F word. If it were me, I would regret that. Yes.
I don't think it's the F word for me. I thought it was the obnoxious little thing later where she once again was like, we're here to sell movies, and she's trying to shove it in their faces and prove that she was right for what she did in her ad campaign and her attitude. I thought that was what was tactless.
Now, we should remind people that she took out her own Oscar campaign,
which appears to not have had any negative impact whatsoever on her front runner status and her win. So the folks in the Academy didn't care. Some of them did. According to various people I spoke to, some of them really did, but not enough to
We don't know the voting. She might have won by a whisker.
Yes, but who else was in that category? Haley Steinfeld was the only other person I thought. Or no,
Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no, she might have.
I think all three of them got a lot of votes, but obviously Melissa got more. Obviously,
well yeah. Now, yeah. Well, now you were backstage for the Oscars, which is having done it many, many times. It's a daunting task because you're kind of juggling the live show versus the what's going on in the press room. And
it's like you're listening to one thing in one, with one ear, and you're listening to the other with the other, and you're typing and writing and keeping track of things. I literally had a notebook in my lap, and I was taking notes on what the people were saying over in the you know, who were coming through, and I was taking notes on what the people were saying on the show, and I was writing stories. It was wild.
It's a true multitasking challenge.
I love it.
Yeah, I'll never forget Robert Redford receiving his Lifetime Achievement Award, and there he is in the press room answering the questions from all the worldwide journalists, 400 journalists in the room, and all of a sudden they all gasp at once. And it doesn't have anything to do with something he said, but Halle Berry had just won the Academy Award. It was so interruptive that he stopped talking and turned on the television next to him to watch her acceptance speech. I mean, it was...
That was the year that she got bussed by Adrian Brody, right?
No, it was when she won, period. She won the award.
She was rewarding him. That's right. That was the next year.
But now, you were there, but there was one person in the press room that wasn't there, and that was Michael Fleming from Deadline Hollywood. And that's because of something that happened on Friday where Nikki Fink, the editor-in-chief of Deadline Hollywood, released the lineup for the Oscars.
Which turned out to be completely inaccurate, I might add. I mean, they changed it at any rate. Yeah, they hand them out in the press room and they say, don't reveal this before the show. You're not allowed. And I said, it's already been on Deadline Hollywood. And they looked at me and they said, she who will not be named.
Wow. I mean, but do you think that they
just loathe her. I mean, it was very funny. And they punished Fleming, who had nothing to do with it. Because he was given a credential for the backstage area, but Pete Hammond went with his ticket. You know, he went. They didn't punish Pete Hammond,
right? As did Jay Penske, the, I guess, publisher, if you will, of Deadline Hollywood and several other websites, including MovieLine.
But they couldn't punish Nikki because she doesn't go to these things. So Mike Fleming was the one piece of retaliation that they could enforce.
Well, there was a lot of back and forth about whether the Academy had given her the lineup and asked her to promote it. Do you think that's actually true?
No, but someone indeed leaked it to her. The question is, who leaked it to her?
Okay.
The press room, the people, they did not give it to her, but somebody did.
Now, before the Oscars, the day before the Oscars, you were at another awards ceremony over in Santa Monica at the Independent Spirit Awards, which, from what I can tell, based on everybody's Twitter feeds, was freezing.
Cold.
It was like... And then when you watch the ceremony later, every presenter came out and went, wow, it's cold out here.
And then Terrence Howard says, can't you afford any heat? You know, I'm so glad they went back to the beach. It's where they should be. And I enjoyed, I mean, how did it feel watching it at 10 o'clock at night when you already knew all the winners?
Just redundant, frankly.
I mean, was it a good enough show to really be worth your while?
That's questionable. No, I mean, and quite honestly, you could tell, unlike the Academy Awards, which have seat fillers, so if somebody gets up, they fill that seat with somebody to make it look full, it looked empty because everybody was standing by the heaters. So
that's right. They were standing by the heaters, and what was going on was that for the first time, they had commercial breaks, and so everybody was networking madly. They would hop up from their chairs, but instead of like at the Broadcast Critics Awards, the Critics Choice Awards, you know, you really felt like you were part of a television show, and you had to be back in your seat in time for the show to start again. They didn't have that. I mean, there was a guy saying, "Get back to your seats, get back to your seats," but it wasn't reinforced at all, and everybody was just networking and hanging out by the heaters or going outside. You can't legislate with the Indie Spirit Awards, and they just gave up that sense of a good show that you want to have. And I hope they recognize that for next year.
I don't know why they don't do it live, but it really did seem like the difference between Sundance, the Independent Spirit Awards, and Cannes, the Oscars. It was, you know, those two festivals are very different. One is very free and open, which is Sundance, and the other is very stoic and, you know, you have to follow all the rules, and that's Cannes. And it seemed like they're, you know, the award shows followed that tradition.
But it's the same. It's the same thing where there's a push and pull between, you know, what's going to be for the community sitting in the room and what's going to work for them and what's going to make money. And that's 'twas ever thus. And the Indie Spirits are trying to parse that difference as well.
And every year we watch the Oscars, and every year we get upset that it's a boring show. Why we're ever surprised, I don't know.
There are some years where it's quite good, but I do think...
No.
I'm a bigger fan of the Oscar show than you are, Michael.
I watch it every year avidly, but I don't expect it to be that entertaining or good. It's always goofy.
See, for me, it's about looking at facial reactions and sort of, you know... Why they didn't have Hugh Jackman come up on the stage, I don't know. That is a mystery that I would love to have answered. You know, if you're going to set that up, take advantage of him, you know?
And you know, the person they did get up on stage was Kirk Douglas, who, You know,
I thought that was great.
Though. He was great, and I halfway through his shtick there to announce the best supporting actress, I thought they should just leave him up there. Because even though it took him,
he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, because he's had a stroke, you know, his speech is a little is hard for him. But he was funny. His timing was perfect.
I know.
To be honest, I should say I thought it was great that he was there, and I was glad he participated. But it literally not because of the way he spoke, but the fact that they had three different comic bits for him to do: one around McCain, one around Anne Hathaway, and then one when he opened the envelope. It took 10 minutes to hand out that award. 10 minutes, including
the
acceptance speech.
That was part of what was funny. He was playing it. It was. I enjoyed that.
But do you think the Academy Awards just come too late? I mean, now there are so many award shows that it's
I know,
kind of anticlimactic.
Process of it. I mean, they can't push it up too far. A, you have to wait until the end of the year for everything to come out. B, you have to set it up so that everybody can see everything. And you have these committees like the foreign language and the docs and the short. You know, people have to be able to see the material in a timely manner and be able to vote on it. And like if the foreign language especially, there's like 68 movies that have to be seen. So you can't, there's only so much you can rush that stuff. And they're not willing to put everything online. And you know what? They shouldn't. I agree that it's better for people to see things in the theater if they can.
68 movies, and yet Dogtooth was still nominated. So
they have a very arcane and convoluted system that has been in place recently to try and make sure that all the ancient foreign language committee, because that only people who aren't working, only older people who don't have jobs can take the time to see all of these things, that they don't keep going with the sort of mainstream, you know, heart-tugging movies. They're really trying to make sure they get some of the higher quality films in there. Now, Dogtooth is arguable.
No, that's one of the better reviewed foreign films of the year, as is Beautiful. So I thought those were good, great choices to see there.
I'm not a big fan of Dogtooth. I thought it was very sensationalistic.
And I agree with you. I've watched that movie with people who now, you know, have made a joke out of the fact that I made them watch this movie. But they also now refer to certain moments in life as a Dogtooth moment. But that's another story. Now, you are on a podcast every week called Oscar Talk, and of course, the Oscars are over. I know last year the show continued. It's a very popular and very good podcast. You should download it. You can do so at iTunes and the Zune Marketplace. What becomes of the Oscar Talk show now?
Well, Chris Tapley, who's my partner on that, and who ably does the editing chores every week, he's going to take a hiatus from the blog as well as the podcast. I mean, he goes back to his other job, which is writing screenplays, and I'm going to continue on with my blog, but not with the podcast. We're going to reconvene in May at the Cannes Film Festival and talk about what comes out of that, because that's sort of, in a way, the beginning of the next phase of the Oscar season.
Right. Well, that's very true. I mean, when you look at the films that were nominated and the films that were at Cannes, they are very often, and including this year, some of the same.
Yeah, you usually have quite a few that get launched there. And then we'll probably come back at the end of the summer and get started with the real Oscar season again. I mean, I'm toying. I haven't decided with possibly getting into some coverage of the Emmy race this summer. Since I'm a big television watcher, I watch a lot of HBO and Showtime and AMC and even some network television shows. So you know, I'm toying around with some other award season of a different kind this summer, but we'll see what happens.
Well, certainly, we hope to speak to you before then. I know we'll see you at Cannes this year, and you're probably headed off to South by Southwest in a few weeks.
Will do.
But thank you very much for taking the time to join us, especially
Always
after such
a
busy weekend. Thank you.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
And now we don't have to talk about the Oscars for another 11 months.
I have to say, when you're doing a podcast like this, and I can't even imagine what it's like for Anne, by the time they actually hold the show, it's like I can't wait for it to be over.
Well, that's the fatigue factor there, too. That's why the awards are sort of depressed in the ratings over the last, you know, 20 years, because there's so many other award shows now that it seems sort of beside the point by the time you get there. You know, when Christian Bale's won it 8 times in a row, watching him win at the Oscars, even though that's the most important, just isn't that exciting.
fatigue factor is a really good word, and also a good word for some of the news about Charlie Sheen that we are about to discuss. And in fact, we have a new registered, trademarked, copyrighted segment on our program called the Charlie Sheen's Headline Marathon.
Wow.
Yes, I've done all of them. I filed all the paperwork for everything. So now, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Okay, I'll start. Charlie Sheen rages an open letter.
Charlie Sheen mocks Two and a Half Men co-creator Chuck Lorre.
Charlie Sheen accused of anti-Semitic remarks.
CBS pulls plug on rest of season for Two and a Half Men.
Charlie Sheen parties with baseball stars and watches Major League.
Producers of Major League sequel say Sheen must clean up his act.
Charlie Sheen texts about TV series deal with HBO.
HBO denies talks with Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen asks for a $3 million raise.
The five craziest things Charlie Sheen said in the past 24 hours.
Charlie Sheen burns CBS by giving an interview to ABC and then burns ABC by giving an interview to NBC.
Charlie Sheen passes home drug test.
Charlie Sheen's publicist quits.
Charlie Sheen shopping book deal, starting bid, $10 million.
Charlie Sheen headed back to work on Tuesday.
CBS will pay Two and a Half Men crew for unshot episodes.
Wow. Yes, there's no question that, you know, if you're trying to drive traffic to your website, Charlie Sheen has been a godsend in the last week. Craig Ferguson, who is the late night talk show host, made his name in part by one episode where he said, "I'm not going to make fun of Britney Spears. The woman needs help. We should all stop making fun of her and help her get help." And actually, last night on his show, he said, "You know what? I'm not going to make fun of Charlie Sheen. It feels too weird and uncomfortable." And he said, "When a late night talk show host refuses to make jokes about you, that's a pretty good sign that it's time you need some help."
Now, have you listened to any of the audio tapes of his interviews with these? I don't know who this radio host is, but
I've seen text of it, and he definitely has sort of megalomaniacal, crazy comments coming out here left and right, but he's all over the place. I think what's really interesting for us is, of course, what the reason ABC finally took CBS finally took action and what it's going to mean financially and how they're going to deal with this.
Well, now they finally took action. Two and a Half Men is a sitcom airing on CBS. Chuck Lorre,
it's the number one sitcom in the country.
And Chuck Lorre is its producer and showrunner. And of course, he produces Mike and Molly and he produces The Big Bang Theory. So CBS kind of likes this guy because he's making them a mint. Charlie Sheen believes it's really all him. It's really all about him, and he's the reason that everybody tunes in each week.
And he's right.
He's gone off, well, yeah, that's probably true. He's gone off the rails, though, and if you really should listen to the radio shows that he appeared on, where he actually called Chuck Lorre, I think, Chaim Levine, so it was a somewhat anti-Semitic remark, and he badmouths him quite a lot. And CBS finally said, "You know what? We can take you trashing a hotel room. We can take you, you know, racing off to the hospital because apparently you have a hernia, but we can't take you bashing Chuck Lorre."
The New York Times has a sort of confused opinion piece by David Carr saying that, you know, Hollywood doesn't care if you're misogynistic and mistreat women, but they don't want you insulting their bosses and their, you know, their executives. And that's why they finally acted. But the question remains, why did CBS finally act? I mean, Charlie Sheen is willing to go back to work. He's passed drug tests. He's willing to do the show. Why, you know, why did they decide to pull the plug?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're right. Radar Online, which is kind of a gossip site, went over to his house and had, you know, I guess a court lab draw blood.
He did a legitimate drug test. Yeah, yeah, they drew blood.
Yeah, and he passed. Well, he passed. He hasn't done any drugs in the last 72 hours is what he
passed. Well, no. A blood test can track pretty far, much farther than that, I would think.
Yeah, that's true. It did not surprise me, though, that Charlie Sheen's publicist, Stan Rosenfeld, finally quit.
Well, when somebody doesn't listen to anything you say, you feel like at some point your credibility is at stake. If they're not willing to listen to you and do anything, you know, they're not willing to follow any of your advice, at some point, for your professional reputation, you need to step away. You don't want to be seen as abandoning someone, but you also want to make clear that they're not letting you do your job, so you've got to walk away.
Right. Now, you know, I can't answer your question, Michael. I have no idea why CBS pulled the plug finally after months of bad behavior. But maybe I think the behavior was coming so bad that it was really beginning to look bad that CBS was allowing it to continue by not pulling the show.
I guess, but it is the number one show. There's estimates anywhere from tens of millions up to 100 million if the show is canceled for good. Of lost revenue that they might have. CBS says, "Oh no, the short term this is no big deal, and long term we'll be fine." You know, it depends on what show they replace it with and how it does. But there's no question, if you kill the number one show in the country, the number one sitcom, I should say, even if you're paying $4 million an episode to air it, you're still, you know, it's still a worthwhile show for you to have on the air. It props up other shows. They've launched other hit shows behind it, like, you know, Big Bang Theory, which aired right before it, and Mike and Molly, which airs after it. It's a big piece of your puzzle.
Yeah, I mean, CBS stands to lose potentially $96 million if the show never comes back. Local cable channels will lose quite a lot of money, as will Warner Brothers stands to lose close to, as you mentioned, $250 million.
So did they just cancel the show outright? Is that possible? Some other people have said, no, that's crazy. They're just, you know, they're just trying to play hardball with him and get him to shape up. But I don't know. It feels like it's a serious possibility.
If you listen to that radio, the tape of that radio show, I can't see how you bring someone like that back with him in his present state of mind. He is off the rails. And I don't mean he's high or something like that. I mean, it might be crystal meth. I don't know what it is, but...
But he's never misbehaved on the set. He's only missed one rehearsal in the entire run of the show, that he's always been professional there. They've never argued that he wasn't professional on the set. They've never argued that he was a problem as far as that is concerned. And what else should concern them?
Right. Well, and, you know, there's some talk that maybe John Stamos might fill in for him or replace him, not as the same character, but a different character. And John Stamos put those rumors to rest by getting on Twitter and saying, no, I am not in talks to star in 2.5 Men. However, Martin Sheen has called me and asked me to be his son.
Of course, before he made that sort of joking tweet, he did give a more, politic public comment where he said, no, he hasn't been approached. And right now, you know, he just hopes that Charlie Sheen will, you know, be well and pull everything together and be all right. You know, that they were thinking about him, which was the polite thing to say. But he's certainly the first person that sprang to mind for me. Another possibility would be moving Big Bang Theory back from Thursday to Monday night and make that the Monday night 9 p.m. show. That's their second biggest sitcom. It's having to face American Idol, so that's been very rough on Thursdays. So that might be another option to sort of shore up their Monday night lineup, which has been a big deal for CBS for a long time now. But then, of course, Charlie, you know, that would mean they were canceling the show outright, which is a possibility. And frankly, if they do, Charlie Sheen says he's going to sue for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, of course. But I think he'd have a pretty good case, don't you?
Well, certainly he's under contract, although, you know, there are lots of little clauses in those contracts that could come back to bite him. So, you know, yeah.
But he's had so many years of misbehavior that for them to suddenly say, now we've decided it's a problem, especially when your character is a rapscallion and you have no on-set problems with him and the co-creator says he doesn't want to do the show without him, I don't see it. I mean, you know, they can't suddenly now invoke a morals clause. He can say, excuse me.
Right.
You know, give me a break. You know, that's not going to fly, I don't think, in a court of law.
I was just trying to drum up some ratings for the show by acting like my character.
Yeah, and again, if he has no misbehavior on the job, I don't think his off-camera antics when they're, in tune with the character, I just don't see how they can argue it.
No, I mean, we could talk about this for the rest of the show, but we should probably move on, don't you think?
Please.
Okay, well, then another story in television news is about Amazon, who has added streaming video service for all of its Prime members, of which I am one of the 5 million Prime members that Amazon has, and I can get my packages in 2 days, and now I can watch my videos instantly, except if I want to watch them on a TiVo, because it streams 5,000 movies to, I guess, 200 different devices, including computers and the Roku box and Apple TV. Well, I don't know if it does Apple TV, but it certainly doesn't do TiVo, which is the one device you'd think that you would want it on.
Well, TiVo, I think, has been struggling for a long time. I don't know what their platform is anymore, but they've been supplanted by, you know, the DVRs that cable companies provide for free. I've never had one, and I don't think that's not the dominant device anymore by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I've had TiVo since 2003. I love it. Everybody should go out and get it. You can get Amazon Video on Demand, Netflix, Blockbuster for as long as they're open.
But have you tried this service yet?
I have tried the service. The video quality is okay. It's not great. Certainly, I watched a bit of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and the subtitles were all fuzzy. So,
were you watching it on your computer, or were you somehow getting it to your television?
To my computer.
Uh-huh.
I can't get it to my television unless I go out and get a Roku box, and I can't get it on my iPad because the iPad doesn't support Flash.
And is it a pretty good collection of recent titles, or is it a mishmash of nothing? Because 5,000 is obviously very little.
It's a mishmash of nothing. And of course, Netflix has, I think, twice the number of titles available for streaming. So we'll see. Does it make you want to become a Prime subscriber?
I'm not even a Netflix subscriber. I get free DVDs because I review them. So I'm an unusual case. I get so many DVDs of movies and TV shows. I've got more than I know what to do with. So I'm just not really in the market for this sort of thing.
Okay. Well, you know, I just wonder how they're paying for all of this, since you'd think that the subscription fee for Amazon Prime would go towards the shipping costs of getting the items to you in 2 days, which is what Amazon Prime started out as, rather than licensing fees. So maybe they're using this as a loss leader. Who knows?
Well, I know now that on Amazon, I mean, you don't get it in 2 days, but frankly, you know, you get free shipping for anything over $25. So it's just not that big a deal anymore, the shipping, I don't think.
Yeah, that's true. But now let me ask you this. The Billboard list of the top 40 moneymakers for 2010, is that a big deal?
It is.
And who were they?
Well, you know, the usual suspects are on there. Lady Gaga is number one, as you might expect, with $30.5 million. Justin Bieber's in there at number five with $23.4 million. Those are certainly, you know, the big hot current acts. But then you look at the rest of the top 10, and it's dominated by touring acts and people who aren't selling a lot of records but are just out there on the road. Touring is where you make the money now. Clearly, album sales are not it. So at number two is Bon Jovi at $30 million. Number three is Roger Waters, who toured with The Wall. Number four is Dave Matthews Band. Number six is Taylor Swift, one of the few people to actually make money on tour and sell a lot of albums. Then Michael Bublé, The Eagles, The Black Eyed Peas, whose new album was a flop, and Paul McCartney. You know, they're all making roughly from $15 to $30 million. And it's all on the road, I would say. That's where they're all making their dough.
Yeah, and U2 is not on here for the first time in a long time. Well, not a long time, but you'd think that they would be on here given that they toured last year. But their tour was cut short, so that's probably why they're not on here.
Yeah, no, they would be on there if they had toured longer.
Yeah.
And but the nice thing is to see that, you know, they can still get a punch in sales. The Grammy Awards did give boost to some record sales. For a while, six out of the top 10 songs on the Billboard singles charts were songs performed on the show, which is great to see. Mumford & Sons went as high as number two on their album, selling over 100,000 copies. So it's nice to see that a big TV award show can get people to go to their computer and download an album, just like in the old days.
Wait, in the old days, they didn't go to their computer, though, I think is the problem, right?
Probably.
The big difference is that there wasn't, yeah. Well, Mumford & Sons, of course, they performed on the Grammys, not only solo, but with Bob Dylan. And this means, since they're now a big hit, that their set at Coachella will be packed.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It'll be a big deal.
Yes, indeed. You know, since you're talking about big deals, we should probably move on then to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story, what's the number one show on Broadway? Is it Wicked? Is it Spider-Man? Turn off the dark. Nope. It's The Lion King, which is the other show on Broadway directed by Julie Taymor. The Lion King has been running for 13 and a half years now, and no show has ever hit number one this late in its run. The last time it hit number one was about 6 years ago. It just goes to show you how profitable a hit a Broadway show can be. Maybe that's why the producers of Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, are thinking of pushing back the show's opening to June. They figure since we just got terrible reviews, why open it officially in March when we haven't made enough substantial changes and are just going to get creamed again? The March 15th opening may now be a quote-unquote celebration of the work done so far, and the June opening, long after the Tony Awards, would be the official opening. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. Now there's no question that they're delaying the opening because, you know, they're going to get bad reviews. And why do it? If they're actually going to make substantial changes, why not? They're making clear it's in previews. People know the show is changing. They don't want anyone to get hurt, but they wouldn't mind a little excitement when they see the show. And what else are they going to do?
Do you think that they could take the show off Broadway and just say, okay, we're going to go on a hiatus for a month or two? And
that's way too expensive. No.
Okay. Well,
I mean, they're making them. Why would they? I mean, they're being paid $1 million. They're being paid $1.3 million a week to work on a show.
Yeah, that's true.
Why should they close it? People are paying to see it.
That's a good point. We predicted Glee would do an episode of all original music in the future. Now they've made one step closer to that by adding two original songs to the current season's plot line of competing in regionals. Lea Michele's character decides the only way they can distinguish themselves and win is by writing their own song. The result? An upbeat track called Loser Like Me and a ballad called Get It Right. Both appear on the fifth CD of tunes coming out from the show and air on the March 15th episode. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but Glee is the biggest, one of the biggest music franchises out there right now, and it's only natural that they should switch and start including some original material.
American Idol has jumped into online voting, just as Simon Cowell's competing The X Factor announced a major agreement with Facebook to allow online voting. Idol announced people can vote on Idol's website by using their Facebook account info. Of course, the biggest change this season has been its permanent move to Thursday, where Idol has proven a big hit on the most profitable night on television. It remains the number one show in the country, and the switch to Thursday has impacted other big hits. Last week, when Idol expanded to 2 hours, CSI hit a series low. Grey's Anatomy? It also hit a series low and was beaten in key demographics not just by Idol, but also by NBC's very low-rated sitcoms, The Office and 30 Rock. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Actually, I don't think it was 30 Rock. That's my mistake. It was I think 30 Rock airs at 10 p.m. But it is a very big deal. The Idol looks like they're just trailing. Even though their online voting starts first, they look like they're following poorly in the wake of Simon Cowell's The X Factor, because they're letting you vote on Facebook, which is a lot more convenient, while Idol makes you go to their own website. And the success of the show on Thursday is just, it's affecting everything on there. It might be one big reason why Big Bang moves back to Monday nights. You know, why not? Why be up against the number one show in the country?
Yeah, so it moving to Thursday is affecting the lineup on other networks.
Oh, yeah.
One of the big complaints about MP3s and other digital downloads of music is that the sound is, what do you call it, the technical term for it? That's right. It sucks. Mind you, since people often listen to that music on tiny little earbuds and portable MP3 players, that didn't really matter. But now that MP3s are often the main source of how people hear music, Apple and others plan to upgrade the sound quality of downloads. Of course, this also comes along with bigger pipes that allow them to send you bigger files without your having to wait hours to get them on your computer. This may be just an increase in quality for the same price and a permanent switch, or it may be a way to bump up the price. Also, Apple plans to offer an quote-unquote upgrade to all your current files, upgrading their audio quality for a certain fee. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big technical deal. It's a step in the right direction. They should improve the sound quality. They can do it now because so many more people have broadband connections. I don't think they should charge more for it for new releases. I think it should just be, hey, now we can make them available in better sound quality. I'm fascinated by the idea of them upgrading all my earlier rips of music. I have, 100,000 songs. I'd love to see what they would want to charge me.
Well, yeah. And that's actually, a lot of the tech blogs were up in arms last week about this because they said, you know what? You're just trying to get us to buy the same music all over again.
But that's not true. I don't think that's true at all. I mean, unless you're talking about the upgrade. No one has to upgrade. But for new titles, if you buy a new release and it's in better sound quality, great. That's why you switch from cassettes to CDs in the first place. I just don't think they should charge you extra for it. I think, if you buy a new album and they can make it available in better sound quality, great.
Hulu predicts it will explode in every way in 2011. The company predicts ad revenue will nearly double from $263 million to $500 million. In 3 years, the site has gone from 2 content partners and a dozen advertisers to 250 content partners and more than 600 advertisers. This all happens as Hulu continues to expand its subscription model to premium services and tries to convince networks and other content providers that it's smart to stick with Hulu. Michael, is this a big deal?
Well, it's a lot of growth, so it's a big deal. It's important for Hulu. They're sort of fighting for their life even as their ad revenue doubles, which seems kind of crazy, but people keep predicting it's going to fall apart and fall by the wayside and everyone's going to go their own way. And NBC is going to have people go to NBC.com and ABC wants people to go to ABC.com rather than Hulu. But if they can keep growing and bringing in more revenue and proving people they're a smart partner, maybe they can make it work.
MTV has the Video Music Awards and the MTV Movie Awards. And now it's decided to finally honor music, as long as the music is online. In a vague new category, MTV is launching the OMAs, which seem like the Online Music Awards, but MTV is way too cool to actually define what the O in the O Music Awards stands for, other than to admit they're going to, quote, honor the migration of music to the digital space and celebrate the art, artistry, and technology of digital music, end quote. Is MTV's new award show a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop since it's sort of vague and stupid and ill-defined. And it's funny that, you know, 30 years after MTV launches, they finally decided they should honor music.
YouTube is close to launching a competitor to Netflix in Europe. As we've reported earlier, YouTube wants to launch a streaming movie and TV show service in Europe while the market is still wide open, and then bring it to the U.S. The New York Post quoted one Hollywood executive as saying they're close, insisting that Google was going to spend $100 million to secure content for the service. Still no word on when the site might launch. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. YouTube is really well placed to be a competitor to Netflix and I guess Amazon. And the more competitors, the better it is for the industry. You don't want just one person to dominate a whole area of business.
Look, if you had one shot or one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted, one moment, would you capture it or just let it slip? That's what Eminem is asking himself as he passes Lady Gaga to become the most liked living pop star on Facebook. Passing her Gaga-ness with 28.88 million users liking him, a smidge past her 28.87 million. Up next, passing the late Michael Jackson's 29.1 million likes to be the all-time champ. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And how many times can I say like in one sentence?
It's a goofy little big deal. It actually matters. You know, you got to have a presence online. It shows how, I mean, 28 million people, that's a lot of million, that's a lot of people to say they like a pop singer. And it's why he's, you know, the best selling artist of the past decade. And it's one more indicator of how their popularity is reflected, not just in album sales.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, it's the ability to reach out to nearly 30 million fans. That means something.
Yeah, I agree.
Ebooks just got more expensive. Random House switched from the wholesale model to the agency model for its ebooks. Now, if you don't know what that means, it means that Random House sets a price and a commission for the seller, say 30%, and that the seller cannot lower the price. On the wholesale model, the sellers, Barnes & Noble or Amazon or, well, any seller, will buy the books at a bulk rate and decide what to charge for it on their own. This means ebook prices will go up. Publishers are glad because they get more money. Indie bookstores are glad because they believe it means they can compete better with giant retailers like Amazon. People who actually buy books and think a digital file should be less expensive than a physical book, not so glad. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. They're going to raise the prices. They're freaking out at the idea that people expect ebooks to cost $10 or $12. They want to charge you the same price they do, basically, for a physical book. And I think it's a bad, bad move, but they're going to do it.
And one can see their point, Michael. I mean, really what they're saying is a book is worth a certain amount because of its intellectual value and intellectual property, not just the material it's made of.
But they're wrong. When a book suddenly costs a lot less to make and produce and distribute around the world, you should pass on that savings to consumers. It's radically cheaper to make one digital file and download it to people than to actually physically produce a book, print it up, ship it to stores, hope people buy it, have them ship it back to you, ship it to remainder houses, hope they can sell it for a dollar, have them ship it back to you, and then depulp them. You know, all that shipping back and forth is gone.
Well, that seems like a lot of work.
It is. And there's no reason not to say, hey, guess what? You know what? The idea that the cost of making the book is minimal is ridiculous. It's always been a part of the cost of the book, and now that it's gone, it should be cheaper to sell the book. And people know that, and they want to lie and say it's not true, but it is. So we edit books, we fact-check them, we do so much other than make them. Yeah, but you know what? A lot of the cost is the making of them. That's certainly $2, $3, $4.
So you're talking about hard material costs.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about ebooks, we talked about Charlie Sheen, we talked about all the big news stories and Big Deal or Big Whoop, and of course the Oscars, which brings us to our weekly segment, Inside Baseball, where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, I guess really only people in Hollywood might care about this, because certainly nobody's going to visit their local Blockbuster, otherwise they wouldn't have filed for bankruptcy and be up for sale.
So they're declaring bankruptcy and they're selling themselves to debt holders? I mean, they're doing everything all at once? What's going on here?
Well, no, they already declared bankruptcy, but now they agreed to sell themselves for $290 million to a consortium of its debt holders in a pact that gives the buyers kind of the option to convert the video rental chain's Chapter 11 bankruptcy, where they were restructuring themselves, into a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which would mean they have to liquidate, meaning they would close all the stores.
Is there any reason why they wouldn't just liquidate Blockbuster?
Because the name is and the brand is worth something, and they might want to use it in other ways, in other capacities.
Well, they might sell it, but as far as the chain of stores, the hundreds, and they're already going to close down 600 stores, and they've probably got, I don't know how many left, 1,000, couple thousand, I don't know what how many are left, but, you know, is this, I mean, the real estate is probably worth more than the video stores.
Well, that's right, and they have to get out of all those leases, and filing for bankruptcy helps with that.
And of course, as we said, they're selling themselves for $290 million, and this is about 17 years after Viacom bought Blockbuster for $8.4 billion.
Yeah, I don't think they got the good end of that deal.
Well, I don't know. They did it. They spun it off to an initial public offering. Maybe they made their money and walked away in time. I don't know what the logistics are of it. I was a little surprised by the note about Universal and other studios who were suing Blockbuster for money.
Well, you kind of have to do that. That's kind of a legality. If you don't sue, you're not in a position to claim something. And so what they're doing is they're putting the courts on record saying we have a lien effectively against Blockbuster. So when the liquidation occurs and the millions of dollars come in, or the $290 million comes in, whatever it is, we're owed $7 million. We're not going to get the $7 million, which is how much 20th Century Fox is owed, or the $9.5 million, which is how much Summit is owed. But we are now on record as saying, this is how much we're owed. Put us on the list.
I'm not surprised that they made the lien. I'm just surprised that the number is so low.
Well, remember, they probably weren't shipping as much. They really just weren't feeding them the DVDs that they needed to, knowing that they weren't going to file for bankruptcy.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, I'm still like, wow, just $7 million. That's it. You know, so those are like, you've got two or three major studios right there. That's about 21, 30 million. So it sounds like, I guess, $80 million maybe dollars in debt to all the studios. I guess that's a lot of money.
Right. And Universal kind of pointed out initially when Blockbuster filed that unless Blockbuster continued to pay the studios, they would not be able to secure their content during their reorganization process. And they said, without the complete ongoing support of the studio, the company said in court documents at the time, Blockbuster essentially would be out of business, as opposed to what it's going through now.
Right. It's the end of an era.
Yeah. And, you know, quite honestly, it's a great lesson. Well, you know, if a lesson can be pulled from this and be called great, that as a business, you have to be somewhat agile and pivot. Because they were in the prime position to go from DVDs to streaming, and they just totally blew it.
Well, they blew the model of shipping DVDs to people's homes. They blew the video streaming online business. They blew DVD sales. Frankly, DVDs went from a rental, you know, movies went from a rental to a sell through business, and Blockbuster dragged its feet every step of the way on that. I mean, most of the money is made on sales, and Blockbuster never made it a center for selling DVDs, which is insane. You'd go to their store and they'd have tons of space devoted to new releases and very little to sell through. So you wouldn't go there to buy stuff. You know, they've missed every step of the way. It wasn't just one mistake. It was a lot of them.
Mistakes. That seems to be the kind of theme of this particular episode. It was a mistake to have James Franco as the host. It was a mistake not to do DVD by mail. It's a mistake for you, really, not to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. That's for sure. You can also subscribe to us in your RSS reader. You can find all of those links on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, which can be found in our show notes for episode 94. You can find ways to keep up with us on Twitter or Facebook. You can find, everything on our website. The music at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It's michaelgiltz.com. He's also on Twitter at Michael Giltz is the username to look up. I'd like to thank Ann Thompson for joining us. She's over at IndieWire. ThompsonOnHollywood.com is one way to get to that blog. You can also follow her on Twitter at AK Stanwyck is the username to follow. We'll place links to those in our show notes as well. I'm on Twitter at Sperling is the username to follow, and you can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week. Play nice.